This episode is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 3 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. You can check it out at CertFuel.com.
Yep, highly recommend checking them out.
So imagine waking up on a Monday morning. You pour yourself a cup of coffee. You log into your brokerage account just to, you know, check on a quick futures trade you put on last Friday.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I know where this is going.
Right. And you realize you don't just have a balance of zero.
That would be the good scenario in this case.
Exactly. Instead, you actually owe the clearinghouse $50,000. And the market is it's still moving against you as you sip your coffee.
Terrifying. Just the absolute worst way to start a week.
It really is. Today, we're talking about the exact mechanical mistakes that cause that literal nightmare to become a reality. And more importantly, how to make sure you are never, ever on the wrong side of an infinite risk trade. Welcome to this deep dive into what is basically the capstone of the speculation chapter for the Series 3 exam. We are getting into trading applications.
It's such a vital topic. I mean, we really need to set the stakes right out of the gate here, because that $50,000 deficit you just described, that is not hyperbole.
No.
It happens to undisciplined traders all the time. And if you're preparing for the Series 3, you probably already know that part one of the exam covers roughly 71% of your total score across those first seven chapters.
Which is a massive chunk.
Massive. The NFA, the National Futures Association, they don't publish the exact per unit weightings. But I can tell you from decades of looking at this material, this specific unit is huge. It is heavily, heavily tested.
I think it's heavily tested because this is where all those theoretical mechanics we've been studying finally crash headfirst into the messy reality of the market.
That is a great way to put it.
Up until now, we've just been, you know, looking at the engine blocks in a sterile garage.
Right. Throughout your study so far, you've been learning the basic definitions, like what is a future? What is an option? What's the difference between initial margin and maintenance margin?
The vocab words.
Exactly. But our mission for this deep dive is entirely different. We aren't introducing any new derivative products today.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. And we aren't memorizing new margin calculation formulas either. This discussion is entirely about one core concept, and that concept is judgment.
Judgment. I love that word for this. It's where you stop calculating,
yeah.
You put down the calculator, and you actually start deciding.
Right.
Because out there in the real markets, and certainly on the hardest questions of the Series 3 exam, nobody hands you a neatly solved worksheet.
They absolutely do not.
You're given a view of the market, a specific risk tolerance, and you just have to pick the right tool for the job. And perhaps more importantly, once you're in the trade, you have to know how to construct an airtight safety net so you don't end up owing that 50 grand.
Right. Given a specific market view, what position do you take? And then what exact order types do you use to initiate that position?
And what specific orders do you use to protect it?
Exactly. The exam will test your ability to chain those specific decisions together flawlessly.
So before we start metaphorically throwing our money at the screen and placing orders in the live market, we need to know where we're trying to go.
We need a map.
We need to map out the different market outlooks that drive these decisions. And to do that, listener, I want you to lock three distinct recurring characters into your brain right now.
These three are going to save you on test day.
They are going to guide us through every single scenario in this deep dive.
A speculative trade is fundamentally built by matching a position to a market outlook. The outlook is your destination. The position you take is just the vehicle you choose to drive to get there.
Exactly. So let's meet the drivers.
Yeah.
First up, we have bullish Barry.
Classic Barry.
Barry is that guy who is always aggressively optimistic. He expects prices to rise. He thinks the economy is booming. Crop yields are going to be incredibly valuable. Tech demand is skyrocketing.
The only possible direction for the market is straight up for Barry.
Right. Then, sitting across the desk from him, we have bearish Brenda.
Oh, Brenda!
Brenda expects everything to crash. She is deeply cynical. She thinks the macroeconomic sky is perpetually falling. Her primary goal in life is to figure out how to profit on the way down while everyone else is panicking.
Brenda is essentially a financial doomsday prepper.
She really is. She's got canned goods in the basement and a massive short position in her brokerage account.
Exactly.
And finally, we have our third character, Neutral Ned.
Good old boring Ned.
Ned does not care if the market goes up, and he doesn't care if it goes down. Ned thinks the world is fundamentally boring, and that prices are just going to bounce around in a tight, sideways, mind-numbingly dull range for the foreseeable future.
Right. And the crucial underlying why behind these three characters is that their outlooks do not just materialize out of thin air.
Right. They aren't just guessing.
Exactly. When bullish Barry or bearish Brenda form a view, it is derived from specific market catalysts. It comes from economic circumstances,
Like what?
like a sudden geopolitical supply shock in crude oil. That makes Brenda think prices are going to spike. Or perhaps a massive overplanting report from the USDA that makes Brenda super bearish on corn.
Okay, so fundamental data.
Fundamental data, yes. Or their views could come from technical circumstances, like a chart breaking through a massive multi-year resistance level. That signals to Barry that a huge upward breakout is imminent.
So the prompt on the exam is going to give you this elaborate backstory. It'll tell you about the USDA report or the hurricane hitting the Gulf Coast or the chart pattern.
They love setting the scene.
But listener, I need you to stop whatever you are doing right now and picture a giant flashing neon sign. Exam trap alert.
This is a big one.
This is one of the most common ways people fail this section. The recommendation you choose on the test must follow the stated outlook in the question prompt.
Absolutely, regardless of what the last price bar on the chart did.
Yes. The exam writers are notorious for this.
They are so sneaky. They will purposefully give you conflicting information between the recent price action and the fundamental outlook just to test your discipline.
Let me ask you a direct question, listener. Think about this carefully. I'll give you a second to answer in your head.
Play along, it helps it stick.
If the exam says the price of soybeans just shot up 50 cents yesterday, making this massive bullish green candle on the chart, but your underlying thesis, the outlook provided in the text of the question, states that you expect a sudden, massive supply glut of soybeans to hit the global market tomorrow.
Okay, so big green candle yesterday, but a huge supply glut coming tomorrow.
Right. Do you buy soybeans? Take a beat.
What's the call?
No. You absolutely do not buy.
Not a chance.
You follow your bearish thesis, the supply glut. You do not follow yesterday's price action.
Because if you expect a supply glut, prices are fundamentally going to fall. Supply will overwhelm demand. You must side with bearish Brenda.
Even though the chart looked pretty yesterday.
Exactly. If you buy just because the price went up yesterday, you are entirely ignoring the fundamental outlook provided in the prompt. The exam tests your mechanical discipline here. Do not chase the shiny object of yesterday's price. Follow the stated outlook to the letter.
Follow the outlook. The destination is set.
Yep.
So now that we know where Barry, Brenda, and Ned want to go, let's talk about the vehicles they can use to get there. Because they do not all drive the same car.
They definitely do not.
And this brings us to the second coordinate of any trade, which is risk tolerance.
Direction is only half the battle. You can have the completely correct destination in mind, but if you choose a vehicle that you cannot handle, you're in trouble.
Like, what do you mean?
I mean, if your risk tolerance is very low, but you choose a highly leveraged, infinite risk tool, you are going to crash and burn before you ever reach the destination. The margin calls will wipe you out.
Let's look at how they express their views, starting with bullish Barry.
Okay, Barry expects upward momentum in the market. Let's say he is incredibly bullish on live cattle. What are his options?
Well, if Barry wants absolute maximum exposure to the price of live cattle, he can go long futures.
Just buy the contract outright.
Right. This means he buys the futures contract. For every single tick the price goes up, his account is credited. For every single tick it goes down, his account is debited.
Fast and loose.
Going long futures is like riding a high-speed motorcycle on the highway with absolutely no helmet, no leathers, and the throttle taped wide open.
That is a terrifying image.
You feel every single bump in the road in your bones. It is full exposure. It is maximum leverage. Because of the low margin requirements in futures, if the price of cattle goes up just a little bit, Barry makes a fortune relative to his capital.
But if the price drops,
He feels every single dollar of that loss instantly pulled from his margin account.
which is exactly why he might want an alternative vehicle.
No.
Because if Barry is still fundamentally bullish, but he looks at his account balance and realizes he cannot stomach the unlimited downside risk of holding the outright futures contract,
Right. The motorcycle is too scary.
he can change his vehicle. He can choose to buy a long call option instead.
Okay, a long call. Let's unpack the mechanics of this because it's so important.
Let's do it.
I like to think of buying a long call option as buying a non-refundable all-access VIP ticket to an outdoor theme park.
I like where this is going.
You pay, let's say, $50 for the ticket up front. That is your premium. You hand over the cash, and it's gone.
Sunk cost.
Yep. If the weather is beautiful and the park is open, you get to go in and ride $1 million worth of roller coasters. The upside is fantastic, totally unlimited fun.
Okay.
But if a massive thunderstorm rolls in and the park is closed all day, what is your absolute worst case scenario? Listener, think about it. Do you have to pay for the theme park's operating costs? Do you have to pay the staff?
Do you owe the roller coaster mechanic his hourly wage?
No. You just lose the $50 you paid for the ticket. It expires worthless, and you walk away frustrated, but not bankrupt.
That is a perfect mechanical analogy. With a long call, Barry's financial risk is strictly and mathematically limited to the exact premium he paid to enter the trade.
Just the $50.
Just the $50. He cannot lose a single penny more than that premium, regardless of how far the underlying futures market falls. But he still gets the upward directional exposure he wanted. If the market skyrockets, the value of his call option skyrockets right along with it.
Wait, if the long call is so great and limits his risk perfectly, why wouldn't Barry just do that every single time?
That's the logical next question.
Why ever ride the dangerous motorcycle of long futures if the theme park ticket exists?
Because the theme park ticket has a catch, and the catch is the premium itself. It is a sunk cost. When you buy a futures contract, you just post margin. You don't actually pay a premium to the other side to own it.
Right, margin is just a good faith deposit.
Exactly. But when you buy an option, you are paying cash out of pocket for that privilege of limited risk. The market doesn't just have to go up. It has to go up enough to clear what he paid just to break even.
Oh, right. He's starting in a hole.
Yes. And worse, options have an expiration date.
Ah. So if it doesn't rain, but the park doesn't open till 5 p.m. and your ticket expires at 4 p.m., you still lose your $50.
Time decay is a killer. It is eating away at the ticket's value every single day.
So if the market goes completely sideways, neutral net is happy, but bullish Barry loses his entire premium simply because time ran out.
Precisely. So he trades the risk of unlimited loss for the certainty of a fixed cost and a ticking clock.
What if Barry is feeling a bit cheap? Let's say he is still bullish, he wants limited risk, but he hates the idea of paying a massive premium for a long call. Can he build a budget vehicle?
Yes, he can. This is where he can construct a bull spread.
A spread.
A spread involves taking two simultaneous positions in the options market to offset costs. In a bull spread, Barry might buy a call option at a lower strike price, say a 1500 call, and simultaneously sell a call option at a higher strike price, say a 1550 call.
Hold on, let's pause here. If he is bullish, why on earth is he selling a call? Selling a call gives someone else the right to buy from him. That sounds like he's betting against himself.
It does sound completely counterintuitive at first glance, but it's purely a financing mechanism.
Okay, explain that.
By selling the 1550 call, Barry collects a premium from another trader. He takes that cash and uses it to subsidize the expensive 1500 call he just bought. Let's put some numbers to it to make it concrete.
Sounds good.
Let's say buying the 1500 call costs him $500 out of pocket. That's a lot of money. But he sells the 1550 call and collects $200.
Okay, so he gets $200 back immediately.
Exactly. Now, his net out-of-pocket cost is only $300. He just reduced his upfront risk from $500 to $300.
Okay, that sounds brilliant. I love a discount. But there's no free lunch in the market. What did Barry give up to get that $200 discount?
He gave up his unlimited upside potential. Because he sold the 1550 call, if the market explodes to $1,600, $1,700, $1,800, the person who bought that 1550 call from Barry is going to exercise it.
Oh, I see.
Barry will be forced to hand over the underlying asset at 1550, completely capping his gains. So a bull spread lowers his initial cost, but it strictly caps both his maximum profit and his maximum loss.
It's the budget sedan of trades.
Exactly.
It will get you to the destination reliably, but it's not going to win any drag races, and there's a governor on the engine that cuts the fuel if you go over 65 miles an hour.
That's a great analogy.
Okay, so Barry is sorted. He can choose the motorcycle, which is long futures, the theme park ticket, which is a long call, or the budget sedan, which is a bull spread.
Yep, he's got his options, literally.
Now let's cross the desk to bearish Brenda. Brenda is expecting downward momentum. The world is ending. Crocs are overabundant. Demand is dying. She wants to profit from a crash.
Brenda's first option for maximum unadulterated exposure to a falling market is to go short futures.
Selling purse.
She sells the futures contract first at today's high price with the sole intention of buying it back later at a lower price and pocketing the difference. But here is the massive fundamental why that you must understand for the exam and for your financial survival.
lean in for this one, listener.
Shorting futures carries theoretically unlimited risk.
We need to unpack this immediately because the phrase unlimited risk gets thrown around a lot in finance, but it is a terrifying, very real concept. Why is it mathematically unlimited?
Let's compare it to Barry's long position. If you are long futures, your maximum risk is capped by the floor of zero.
Right. Prices can't go below zero, usually.
Right. If Barry buys crude oil at $80 a barrel, the absolute worst thing that can happen, barring rare historical anomalies like we saw in April 2020, where oil briefly traded negative due to storage issues, but normally the worst case is the price of oil goes to zero. He loses $80 per barrel.
It's a terrible day, but the loss has a mathematical boundary.
Exactly. But if Brenda is short, she makes money as the price goes down, which means she loses money as the price goes up. And mathematically, the exam assumes there is no ceiling to how high a price can rise. A price can go to infinity.
Listener, picture this. I'm going to give you an absurd scenario so you never forget this. Imagine bearish Brenda shorts orange juice futures at $150, expecting a bumper crop to flood the market.
Okay.
But over the weekend, an unprecedented super hurricane completely wipes out the entire state of Florida.
Yeah.
Every single orange tree is gone.
Just flattened.
And on top of that, a new, highly contagious invasive insect eats all the remaining oranges in Brazil. The global supply of orange juice drops to absolute zero overnight.
Brutal devastation.
When the market opens on Monday, the price of orange juice doesn't drop. It skyrockets from $150 to $300, then to $600, then to $1,200. And Brenda, because she is short, is on the hook for every single penny of that upward explosion.
And it isn't just a paper loss on a screen. As that price is screaming upward, the clearinghouse is actively looking at Brenda's account. They demand maintenance margin.
The dreaded margin call.
Yes. They will issue margin calls demanding she wire tens of thousands of dollars into her account immediately just to keep the position open. If she can't, they will unilaterally liquidate her position at the absolute worst possible price, locking in a catastrophic loss that could exceed her entire net worth.
That is unlimited risk. That is the $50,000 deficit I mentioned in the intro.
It is the stuff of nightmares.
So, knowing that, Brenda might want some insurance. She might prefer her second option, which is a long put option.
The long put is the limited risk substitute for shorting futures.
How does buying a put protect her from the super hurricane scenario?
Buying a put gives Brenda the contractual right, but not the obligation, to sell the underlying futures contract at a specific strike price, regardless of where the market is trading.
Okay.
Let's say she buys a put with a strike price of $150. She pays a premium for this right. If her bearish thesis is correct and the market crashes to $50, her put becomes incredibly valuable because she holds a contract that lets her sell at $150 when everyone else is selling at $50.
She's selling high while the market is low.
Right. But if the hurricane hits and the market skyrockets to $1,200, what happens to her put?
It's just like Barry's theme park ticket. The market is at $1,200, so her right to sell at $150 is totally useless.
Mm-hmm.
Why would she sell at $150 when the open market is paying $1,200? She just throws the put option in the trash.
Exactly. She lets it expire worthless. Her worst case scenario, even amidst a global market-breaking price spike, is simply losing the upfront premium she paid for the put.
Which hurts, but she's not bankrupt.
Right. It puts a concrete mathematical cap on that terrifying unlimited risk.
Can she also do a bear spread? Like Barry's budget sedan, but in reverse?
She can. If Brenda has a modest directional view, meaning she thinks the market will fall, but maybe just a little bit, not a total crash, she can use a bear spread.
So she buys one put and sells another.
Yes. She buys a put at a higher strike and sells a put at a lower strike. The premium she collects from the put she sells subsidizes the put she bought. This lowers her overall cost of entering the bearish position, but just like Barry, it completely caps her maximum reward if the market utterly collapses.
Okay, so Barry goes long, Brenda goes short, they have their vehicles. What on earth do we do with neutral Ned?
Ned is a special case.
He thinks the market is going absolutely nowhere. He looks at interest rates and says, yep, they're going to stay exactly where they are for the next 9 months.
This is a classic, highly testable exam scenario. The exam will outline a situation where a trader expects a flat, sideways, range-bound market and then ask you what position to take. The first thing you must remember is that directional futures are entirely wrong for Ned. You absolutely do not buy or sell an outright future if you expect flat prices.
Why? I mean, if the price doesn't move, I don't lose money, right?
You might not lose money on the price action itself, but you are tying up massive amounts of initial margin capital for zero return.
Oh, that makes sense.
And worse, you are paying transaction costs, commission fees, and potentially suffering from the slow roll yield decay, depending on the term structure of the futures curve. You are just sitting there bleeding out in opportunity cost and friction while nothing happens.
So what does Ned actually do? How do you trade paralysis?
Ned needs a strategy that profits from time passing or relationship stabilizing. He needs a spread, but not a directional bull or bear spread.
What kind of spread then?
He might look at an intercommodity spread or a calendar spread where he cares strictly about the relationship or the difference in price between two legs of a trade rather than the overall direction of the entire market.
Okay.
Or if we stick to the options world, Ned needs a premium collecting strategy. He becomes the insurance company.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Remember how Barry and Brenda were buying options and paying premium? Ned is the guy on the other side. He is selling options.
So if he sells a call to Barry and the market goes completely sideways, Barry's call expires worthless. Who keeps Barry's 50 bucks?
Neutral Ned keeps it.
Exactly. Ned profits simply from time passing, the clock running out, and the market staying quiet. The three meme decays right into his pocket.
It's a very consistent strategy in a flat market.
All right, before we move on to how we actually enter these orders, it is time for another exam trap alert.
Ring the alarm.
I am aggressively flagging this one because it is the number one reason smart people miss questions they actually know the answer to. A directionally correct answer is entirely wrong if it ignores a risk instruction.
This trips up so many test takers every single year. They read half the prompt and they just stop reading.
Listener, listen to the scenario and tell me the answer. The exam prompt says, bearish Brenda wants to profit from a falling market in crude oil. However, she absolutely must limit her risk to a known fixed amount.
Okay, known fixed amount.
You look at the multiple choice options. Option A is short futures. It's a bearish position. Do you pick it? Listener, take a second.
What do you think?
No. Short futures is the wrong answer.
Even though short futures is a perfectly valid bearish position, it violently violates her risk tolerance instruction. Because, as we just exhaustively covered with the orange juice hurricane, short futures carry unlimited risk. A known fixed amount of risk is the exact opposite of unlimited risk.
So what does she do?
She must use a long put or a bear spread. The exam is testing your ability to plot two coordinates here, direction and risk. If you only match the direction, you fail the question.
Direction is the destination. Risk tolerance is the vehicle. You have to match both.
Exactly.
So we've got the right vehicle and we've got the right safety ratings for our characters based on their risk tolerance. But how exactly do they get the keys, turn on the ignition, and put the car in drive? Let's talk about initiating orders.
The mechanics of entry.
We're shifting gears right now.
Mm-hmm.
Wake up if you spaced out.
Mm.
We're moving from the conceptual what to trade to the gritty mechanical reality of how you actually execute it on the electronic exchange or the trading floor.
It is a massive shift in mindset. Up to this point, we've talked about the position itself, the long, the short, the option. Now we're talking about the order ticket itself, the actual piece of digital paper you send to the broker.
Right.
And order tickets do two very distinct, very critical jobs. They initiate a position to get you into the market, and later they protect a position to get you out safely.
Let's start with getting in. Let's do a side-by-side comparison of the two most common ways to initiate a trade. The market order and the limit order.
These sound basic, but the nuances are where the exam gets you.
Absolutely.
A market order is the most straightforward tool in the box. It guarantees a fill, but it does not guarantee a price. When you submit a market order to buy, it enters the exchange order book immediately and takes the very best available asking price at that exact second, no matter what it is.
I picture a market order like jumping into a taxi in a foreign city without asking what the fare is.
Yes, that's exactly it.
You're standing on the curb, you throw your bags in, you jump in the back seat, and you yell, drive!
Mm-hmm.
You are 100% definitely getting a ride. The fill is guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
But because you didn't negotiate the price up front, the driver gets to dictate the price. You might get a fair rate, or the driver might take you the long way around and charge you triple.
Yeah.
You don't get to choose exactly what you pay. You just take whatever price is thrown at you when you arrive.
That's a perfect analogy for the mechanics of liquidity, because if the market is highly liquid, like the S&P 500 futures, the taxi driver is fair. The spread between the bid and the ask is tiny, maybe just a tick.
Right.
But if you are trading a highly illiquid market or a market experiencing massive volatility, the next available price might be miles away from the last traded price. You will get filled, but the price might be atrocious.
Okay, now contrast that entirely with a limit order.
Right, a limit order guarantees a price, or better, but it may not fill.
Sticking with the negotiation metaphor, a limit order is like going to a used car dealership with a briefcase containing exactly $20,000.
Okay, I see.
You walk onto the lot, point to a car, open the briefcase, and say, I will pay exactly $20,000 for this car. I will not pay $20,001, not a single cent more.
You've drawn a hard line.
You have guaranteed your price.
Yeah.
But what happens if the dealer says the car is $22,000 and absolutely refuses to budge?
You don't get the car. You close the briefcase and you walk home.
Right.
And that is exactly what happens in the market. If you place a limit order to buy at $1,500, the clearinghouse will only execute that order if they can find a willing seller at $1,500 or lower. If the market is currently trading at $1,505 and it just keeps going up to $1,510, $1,520, your order just sits there, completely unfilled.
You guarantee your price, but you risk missing the massive rally entirely if it never dips down to hit your limit. You are left standing on the lot with a briefcase full of cash while the market dries away without you.
Exactly. So traders have to make a choice upon initiation. Do you want the certainty of a position or the certainty of a price? You can't have both.
Now, what about stop orders for entry? I usually think of stops as a safety net, a way to get out of a losing trade.
Okay.
But the outline says you can use them to get in.
You can, and it is a very specific type of strategy. A stop order can be used to initiate a position if you are trading a breakout or a breakdown.
How does that work?
Let's use bullish Barry as an example. Barry is watching a chart for wheat futures. He sees that for the last 6 months, every time wheat hits a price of $1,500, it bounces back down. $1,500 is a massive ceiling of resistance. The market just cannot break through it.
Okay, it's stuck.
Right. However, Barry believes that if the market can gather enough strength to finally break and hold above $1,500, all the sellers will give up and the price is going to absolutely soar to $1,600.
A breakout.
Yes. So the market is currently trading at $1,490. Barry places a buy stop order above the current market price, exactly at $1,505.
Wait, stop. Let me make sure I'm tracking this. If the current price of wheat is $1,490 and Barry wants to buy it, why in the world is he putting in an order asking to buy it higher at $1,505? That goes against everything we know about buying low and selling high. That sounds like a terrible deal.
It sounds totally counterintuitive to a value investor, for sure, but Barry is not a value investor right now. He is a momentum trader.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't want to buy at $1,490 because he is terrified of that $1,500 ceiling. If he buys at $1,490, the market might rally to $1,500, fail to break through, and collapse back to $1,400. He would lose money.
So he wants proof first.
Exactly. He only wants to initiate the long position if the market actually proves it has the strength to shatter the ceiling. By placing the buy stop at $1,505, he is saying, I am willing to pay a slightly higher price, but only if the market confirms my breakout thesis. The buy stop sits dormant above the market, waiting for that momentum confirmation.
Okay. He is buying strength. Yeah. He is paying a premium for confirmation.
Yes.
And bearish Brenda could do the exact reverse, right?
Yeah.
If she thinks the support floor at 1,400 is going to cave in, but she's not sure yet, she doesn't short at 1,410. She places a sell stop below the market at 1,395. She wants to catch the breakdown. She is selling weakness.
You've got it perfectly. They are using stop orders as entry triggers, essentially programming the exchange to execute their thesis only if the market momentum proves them right.
Okay, so let's fast forward. Let's say Bullish Barry's momentum thesis was right. He used a buy stop, it triggered, and he is now long wheat futures at 1,505. He is in the market. The engine is running. The vehicle is moving.
Good for Barry.
And for a few days, he's making money as the price drifts up to 1520. But what happens if over the weekend, a massive, unexpected global embargo is announced and the demand for wheat instantly evaporates? The market is going to crash.
And Barry is on that motorcycle without a helmet.
Exactly. We need a safety net.
And this brings us to the second and arguably most important job of an order, protecting the position. The absolute core concept you have to memorize here, and you should write this down in big bold letters if you were studying, is that a protective stop always sits on the losing side of a position.
The losing side. Let's do another direct question for you listening. Think about this logically. Do not try to memorize the textbook phrase. Try to understand the physics of the trade.
Visualize it.
Bullish Barry is long. He bought wheat. He wants the price to go to the moon. What direction physically hurts him? Take a second.
Which way causes pain?
Down. If the price goes down, Barry bleeds money from his margin account. So, logically, where does this safety net have to be constructed?
It has to go below the market. To protect a long position, you must use a sell stop placed below your current entry price.
Let's put concrete math to it. Barry buys wheat at $1,500. He looks at his account and decides he is only willing to risk 15 points on this trade. He places his protective sell stop at $1,485. If the market is humming along nicely at $1,510, $1,520, $1,530, the stop order just sits there in the exchange's computer doing absolutely nothing. It is a safety net suspended in the air beneath his high wire act.
Totally inactive.
But if the embargo is announced and the market suddenly plummets, cutting through 1500, 1490, and it hits 1485, boom.
The order triggers, and it automatically sells his wheat contracts, closing his long position and capping his loss right around those 15 points. He takes a loss, but he survives to trade another day. His account is not wiped out.
Okay, now let's look at bearish Brenda. She shorted the crude oil market at $80. She sold first. What direction hurts Brenda? Listener, answer it in your head.
Which way?
Up. She gets hurt if prices rise. Therefore, her safety net has to sit above the market. She uses a buy stop placed above her entry price. Let's say she places it at $85.
And if we connect this back to the bigger picture we discussed earlier, that terrifying concept of unlimited risk, this is exactly why short sellers absolutely require a protective order.
Because there's no mathematical cap otherwise.
Exactly. Because a short position has theoretically infinite risk, the buy stop placed above the market is the only thing acting as a concrete ceiling to prevent total financial ruin.
I want to repeat that because it is so vital. If Brenda shorts at $80 and that super hurricane hits, the price could go to $100, $200, $500. Her losses are mathematically infinite.
That's endless margin calls.
By placing a buy stop at $85, she builds a reinforced concrete ceiling over her head. If the market spikes and hits $85, her stop triggers, she automatically buys to cover her short position, and she is out of the market. She loses $5 a barrel, which hurts, but the unlimited risk of a $400 spike is completely neutralized.
It is logically required for survival in the short selling game. Without it, you are basically playing Russian roulette with your net worth.
Time for another exam trap alert. The test writers are incredibly tricky here.
They love this one.
They know that under pressure, your brain is going to try to match words instead of visualizing the mechanics. They know you're going to memorize phrases without understanding the logic. The answer is choices on the exam will routinely flip the side or the direction to confuse you.
It happens constantly. You will see a multiple choice option that says, to protect a long position, you should place a buy stop above the market.
And if you are rushing through the exam, your stressed brain might quickly associate the words long means buy, means going up. Yeah, buy stop above. That sounds totally right.
But it is completely 180 degrees backwards.
Why?
Think about it. If you are long, you already bought. You own the contract. You don't need to buy it again to get out. You have to sell it to somebody else to get rid of it. So you need a sell order. And because you want to protect against a crash, you place it below the market because that's where the danger is coming from.
Exactly. I always tell people to remember the golden rule. The stop sits on the side that hurts. A long position loses money on the way down, so the stop hangs below like a trapeze net. Short position loses money on the way up, so the stop caps it above like a ceiling. The side that hurts.
The side that hurts. That is the easiest way to remember it.
Now, listener, you might be listening to this and thinking, great, this is easy. Barry set his sell stop at exactly $1,485. So no matter what happens in the world, his absolute worst case exit is going to be exactly $1,485 on the dot, right? He knows exactly what his maximum loss is down to the penny.
Oh, man. This raises a profoundly important question about market mechanics and how exchanges actually process data, because no, that is absolutely not guaranteed.
Not guaranteed at all.
This is where the theoretical textbook reality ends and the messy, chaotic reality of live markets introduces a massive variable.
This brings us to a concept that causes more anger and confusion for retail traders than almost anything else: slippage and the reality of triggers. We need to deeply unpack the mechanical difference between a plain stop order and a stop limit order.
The absolute core concept here, the mechanical truth of the exchange, is that a stop order guarantees a fill, but it does not guarantee a price.
Wait, hold on. Guarantees a fill, not a price. That is the exact same definition we used for the market order when we were talking about the taxi cab earlier.
Precisely. They share that definition because they are fundamentally linked in the exchange's computer system. What is fascinating here is the underlying mechanism of how a stop actually functions. A plain stop order is not a magical barrier. It is really just a conditional trigger mechanism lying completely dormant in the system.
By trigger.
Right. The instant that the market price touches your stop price or trades completely through your stop price, the stop order is elected. It is triggered. And at that exact millisecond, it magically transforms into a regular run-of-the-mill market order.
It's like a sleeper agent in a spy movie. It just looks like a boring, inactive number on a screen for weeks. But once the price hits 1485, the sleeper agent wakes up, grabs a radio, and yells to the exchange, "Market order! Sell everything! Get me out right now at any cost!"
That's exactly it. And remember what market orders do. They take the taxi ride. They take the very next available price in the order book, no matter what that price is. They guarantee you get out of the trade, but they completely surrender the negotiation over the price you get out at.
Let's paint a very vivid slippage scenario, because this is where traders lose their minds. Let's say Barry holds his long wheat position over a three-day holiday weekend. His sell stop is resting peacefully in the system at 1485. The market closed on Friday afternoon at 1500. Barry is sleeping soundly, enjoying his weekend.
Everything is fine.
But on Sunday afternoon, while the exchange is closed, a massive, totally unforeseen geopolitical event occurs. A major wheat-producing country suddenly announces they are dumping their entire national reserve onto the global market. Massive, unprecedented oversupply.
The worst-case scenario.
Right. When the electronic futures market reopens on Sunday night at 6:00 p.m. Eastern, it does not open smoothly. It doesn't trade at 1500, then 1499, then 1495, nicely walking down the stairs. It falls out a window. It gaps down. The very first tick, the very first trade registered on the exchange on Sunday night, is at 1460.
So what exactly happens to Barry's protective stop in the computer? The market opened at 1460. That means it traded completely through 1485 without ever touching it.
Right.
But because the price is now below 1485, the trigger condition is met. The sleeper agent is activated. Barry's stop order instantly becomes a market order to sell. It looks at the order book and says, who is the highest bidder right now? And because the market is in a free fall panic, the highest bidder might not be at 1460 anymore. The next available price might be 1450.
So Barry gets filled at 1450. His safety net was supposed to be 1485. He just lost 35 extra points of his capital, past his absolute worst case scenario.
Exactly. This is called slippage. It is the negative gap between your resting stop price and your actual execution fill price in a fast gapping or highly illiquid market. We saw extreme examples of this during the 2010 flash crash in equities and in crude oil markets during geopolitical shocks. Prices can move so fast that the order book essentially empties out, and market orders have to reach deep down into the abyss to find a buyer.
I can hear people listening to this and getting legitimately angry. Why on earth would I use a stop order if it doesn't even guarantee my exit price? It sounds broken.
It's not broken, though. It's doing exactly what it is designed to do.
Yeah.
Because look at the alternative. The stop guarded against an open-ended catastrophe.
Yeah.
Yes, Barry suffered 35 points of terrible slippage. He is mad, but he is out of the market.
Oh, I see.
If that geopolitical news was so bad that the price of wheat kept dropping to 1400, then 1300 over the next 2 hours, Barry is safe on the sidelines. He took a heavy hit, but he didn't blow up his account. He accepted the penalty of slippage to guarantee the certainty of getting out.
Okay, I understand the logic. But let's say Barry is a total control freak. He absolutely refuses to accept slippage. He says, "I'm the guy with the briefcase. I refuse to sell for anything worse than my price." Is there another tool he can use?
Yes. If a trader refuses to accept slippage, they can use a stop limit order.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison of these two so we can see the danger. Plain stop versus stop limit.
As we just walked through, a plain stop becomes a market order when triggered. It happily accepts slippage to guarantee an exit. A stop limit order has two prices attached to it, a stop trigger price and a limit execution price. When the stop price is triggered, it does not become a market order. It becomes a limit order.
Wait. So let's replay the horrible weekend gap scenario, but this time Barry uses a stop limit. Barry sets a stop limit with a trigger at 1485,
yeah,
and his limit price also at 1485. The market closes Friday at 1500. The news breaks, market gaps down, and the first trade Sunday night is at 1460. What happens?
Well, the market traded through 1485. The trigger condition is met. The sleeper agent wakes up. But instead of yelling, "Get me out at market price," the sleeper agent pulls out a briefcase and says, "I am now a limit order. I will only sell this wheat if someone pays me exactly 1485 or higher."
But the market is currently at 1460, and it's falling to 1450. No one in their right mind is going to pay Barry 1485 when they can buy it on the open screen for $14.60.
Which means Barry's order just sits there in the order book, completely ignored. He guaranteed his price. He refused to sell below $14.85, but because the market gap so far passed him, he doesn't get filled at all.
Wait, pause. Stop. Yep. So if I use a stop limit to protect my position, and the market crashes hard and gaps over my price, I could just be stuck holding the bag. My safety net completely fails to deploy.
Yes. Your long position remains entirely open. You are still fully exposed to the market as it plummets away from your limit price down to $1,400, $1,300. Your account is hemorrhaging cash, all because you refuse to accept a little bit of slippage.
That sounds like an absolutely terrible way to protect a position. Why would anyone use it for protection?
It generally is a terrible way to protect against catastrophic risk, which is why pure protection strategies usually rely on plain stops. Stop limits are more commonly used for entering positions where you want to buy a breakout, but you don't want to overpay if the breakout goes completely parabolic instantly.
Ah, okay.
When it comes to protection, you have to choose which risk you prefer. Do you want the mathematical risk of slippage, or do you want the existential risk of zero protection in a fast-moving market? Experienced speculators almost always choose slippage because surviving to trade another day is the ultimate priority.
Exam trap alert.
Yeah.
Let's flag this clearly. If a multiple choice question on the Series 3 says that a protective stop order guarantees you will exit the trade exactly at the stop price, it is blatantly, demonstrably wrong.
Blatantly wrong. Stops guarantee fills. They do not guarantee prices. Limit orders guarantee prices, but they do not guarantee fills. You cannot have both certainties at the same time.
Which brings us perfectly to the golden rule of protection. When do you actually go into the software and put these safety nets in place?
You must know your exact exit strategy before you ever need it. Protective stops should be placed at the exact moment the trade is initiated.
You don't enter the trade on Monday, wait to see how the market feels on Tuesday, and then maybe put a stop in if you get nervous.
Absolutely not. If you enter the position, you simultaneously enter the protective stop, and you usually set the duration to GTC. Good till canceled. That way, the order rests securely in the exchange's computer system day after day, week after week, until you either close the position yourself for a profit, or you cancel the order manually.
So if a question asks for the best or most prudent strategy, an answer that enters a naked position with no attached protective order is almost always the weak, incorrect answer.
Always. Professional speculation requires risk management at the point of origin, not as an afterthought.
Wow. Okay, we have covered a truly massive amount of ground today. We've gone from the conceptual outlooks of Barry and Brenda to the exact vehicles they drive, all the way down to the gritty psychological reality of weekend price gaps and sleeper agent algorithms.
It's a lot to process.
Listener, if your brain is full, take a breath. We're going to lock this all in right now. I'm going to give you a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most testable facts from this entire deep dive. These are the rules you memorize.
Let's run through them.
Rule number one, the outlook dictates the direction. Your risk tolerance dictates the exact vehicle you use. You have to match both. And crucially, never chase yesterday's price action. Always follow your stated thesis.
Perfect. Rule number two. If the prompt says you need rigidly defined limited risk, you must buy an option. You buy a long call for a bullish outlook and a long put for a bearish outlook.
Rule number three. Remember the side that hurts. Protect a long position with a sell stop placed below the current market price. It hangs like a net.
Rule number four. Protect a short position with a BUY stop placed above the market. It acts as a concrete ceiling to cap your theoretically unlimited upside risk.
Rule number five. A plain stop order guarantees a fill, but it does not guarantee a price. It becomes a market order when triggered. Beware of the slippage in a fast or gapping market.
And rule number six. Always, always establish your protective stop at the exact moment you initiate the position. Use a GTC order so you know your exit before the panic starts.
Incredible. We've mapped the destination, we've picked the right vehicle for the conditions, and we've learned exactly how to aggressively use the brakes when things go wrong.
We covered it all.
But before we sign off, leave us with something to chew on. We've talked so much about mechanics today, but what is the unseen variable here?
The unseen variable is always the psychology of the speculator. We just spent an hour walking through the rigorous math and the exchange mechanics, and we logically, mathematically proved that setting a protective stop is unconditionally required to survive, especially for short positions like Brenda's, where the risk is infinite.
Right. It's just math.
Yet in the real world, out on the physical trading floors and sitting at home in retail brokerage accounts, traders routinely, daily, fail to place these stops.
Why? Why do they do that?
Because human nature fundamentally hates admitting defeat. A stop order forces you to mechanically pre-plan your own failure. It forces you to type a number into a computer and say, if the market hits this price, I admit that my brilliant thesis was completely wrong. And the human ego prevents people from doing that.
They just can't click the button.
Exactly. They would rather hold a losing position and pray for a turnaround than accept the certainty of a small, predefined loss. So as you prepare for the Series 3 exam, and more importantly, as you prepare for your future interacting with these live markets, you have to ask yourself a very hard question. When the screen turns red and the pressure is on, are you going to trade your logically constructed, disciplined plan? Or are you going to let your ego trade your emotions?
Are you
going to
trade your plan or your emotions?
Mm-hmm.
Because I promise you, the clearinghouse does not care about your ego. They only care about your margin balance.
That is the truth.
Judgment. That's what this whole unit was about. You stop calculating, you accept the mechanics, and you start deciding based on discipline.
Well said.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Keep grinding, keep studying those mechanics, and we'll see you next time.